Let's turn to the book of Ecclesiastes right after the book of Proverbs. The book of Ecclesiastes resembles the book of Proverbs in some ways, except that it appears to be, on the whole, much more pessimistic than the book of Proverbs. And it also contains statements that are difficult for us to harmonize with other biblical concepts. And we need to understand what the purpose of the book of Ecclesiastes is, because of all the books in the Bible, probably none more than this book confuses Christians and makes them wonder how it is that this could be called an inspired book. We believe that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for instruction in righteousness. As we read this book, we need to know what the purpose of God was in inspiring the writer to write it, and what profit is there in it for us in learning to have instruction in righteousness, to be corrected, to be reproved. And once we understand the purpose of the book and of the writer, I think it will make a great deal of difference and go a long way toward making the book an easy thing for us to study. It's only 12 chapters long. Some of the chapters resemble, at least on some parts, the book of Proverbs. It'll have Proverbs interspersed, but there is, unlike Proverbs, more of a general theme of the whole book. In fact, the word Ecclesiastes comes from the Latin form of the Greek word for preacher. In the Hebrew Bible, the name of this book is called Koheleth, which means the preacher, or the master of assemblies, or the teacher. The preacher seems to be the most commonly given interpretation of the word, Koheleth. That's spelled Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. That's the Hebrew name of this book. It means the preacher. And several times in the book, the writer identifies himself as the preacher. Some people believe that it's actually written by another person speaking of the preacher, but one way or the other, there is a preacher who is the central figure whose thoughts are given here. So this is called the preacher, and in fact, in your Bibles, it probably says Ecclesiastes or the preacher, Koheleth. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes is in fact a sermon of a preacher. And the text is found in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. In modern English, the word vanity usually refers to foolish pride. But in the Bible language of the King James Bible anyway, in the English of that day, the word vanity had the meaning of emptiness. And that is what the message of this book is, that everything is emptiness. Now, we know that that is not entirely true. Certainly from our point of view as Christians, there's a lot of fullness. We actually have received of His fullness, the Bible says, and grace for grace. However, the writer, from his vantage point, wants to demonstrate the emptiness of life. But not of all life, but of a certain sphere of life. And that is life, as he calls it, under the sun. The expression under the sun appears 28 times in this short book, more than twice per chapter, average. Under the sun. Of course, that means in the realm of natural man's existence. He's saying that when you do not take into consideration God, who is, of course, above the sun, who is over the sun, who is above the universe, not taking into consideration God, everything is emptiness. And there's probably no person who was able to demonstrate this and experiment with this himself more than the man who wrote this book. There's dispute among scholars as to who wrote the book. Many people want to say that it was written after the Babylonian captivity, but the arguments in favor of that are not strong. The evidence from within the book is that it was written, as was the majority of the book of Proverbs, by Solomon. There are good reasons to say that Solomon wrote the book. For example, verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, the king in Jerusalem. Now, we grant that the term the son of David could refer to a descendant of David. Solomon, you know, was the son of David who became the king in Jerusalem. And so the most natural way to see it would be that the preacher is the son of David, Solomon, the king in Jerusalem. As he wrote the Proverbs, so he wrote Ecclesiastes, and there are many similarities between the books, which also serves to help confirm it. If there were any question as to whether this son of David was Solomon or some other descendant of David who later was a king in Jerusalem, we can look at some other places. Verse 12 of chapter 1 says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. As we go further into chapter, in the same chapter, verse 16, he says, I communed with mine own heart, saying, Lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Now, we know that instead of Solomon, that he was given more wisdom than anyone had ever had before. And that he was the greatest man who, or the wisest man who lived, at least in his day. Now, if this were some other son of David, subsequent, or later than Solomon, it's hard to imagine how he could say that he had gotten more wisdom than any king before him, which would mean more than Solomon. Only Jesus is greater than Solomon. Jesus called himself one greater than Solomon, but it's hard to imagine any other of the kings of Judah, inferior as they mostly were, considering himself greater than Solomon in wisdom. This king in Jerusalem said that he had gotten wisdom more than all the others in Jerusalem before him. That certainly would seem like Solomon. Chapter 2 and verse 9, he says, So I was great and increased more than they all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. So he became great and increased, that is, rich, more than all before him in Jerusalem. That would mean he was the richest king of the time. That was true of Solomon in his day. Over in chapter 12 and verse 9, it says, Moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. So the preacher was one who sought out and set in order many proverbs and taught the people wisdom. That's exactly what the Bible tells us Solomon did. And so the strong tradition of the Jews is that the book was written by Solomon. It was later higher critics who've come to try to demonstrate that it wasn't written by Solomon, but by someone much later. But there's no strong, compelling reason to eliminate the age-old tradition that Solomon wrote this. The very claims of the writer point us to Solomon as the author. Now, what this book contributes to us that Proverbs does not is that Proverbs was written, it seems, mostly in Solomon's heyday, when he was doing well. But we're told in 1 Kings chapter 11 that Solomon married many foreign women, and he began to compromise with the religions of their homelands and built shrines for them, and he backslid. It says his many wives took away his heart from the Lord, turned his heart from the Lord. So we know from the statement of Scripture, and that's in 1 Kings 11, 3 through 6 or so, we know that Solomon ceased to please God. He walked away from God. He had been given great wisdom, but he allowed himself to be seduced away from walking in the ways of that wisdom. And he spent, as far as 1 Kings tells us, it sounds like he spent the rest of his life backslidden. However, from this book, we get the impression that at the end of his life, he came back to the Lord and wrote a book to warn us of the dangers of backsliding and of the emptiness of it. What this book is, I believe, is an odyssey of Solomon's own backsliding. He records for us his own philosophical travels, the things he went through, the philosophies he embraced, the things he sought happiness in when he was departed from God, when he was living just as one under the sun, taking into consideration only things on the earthly plane, not taking God into account in all his ways. That is what this appears to be. It seems that Solomon, in his old age, wrote this because in chapter 12 we'll find there's a lamentation about being old and a description of old age that is very graphic, and it seems like the writer must have been old himself to have written it. Further, he exhorts us at the end of the book. He says, What is the conclusion of the matter? Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. It's clear that at the end of the book, he's telling us that he is now back with the Lord. And his conclusion of the book is that we should fear God and keep his commandments. However, in the course of the 12 chapters of the book, especially the first 10 chapters, we have many statements that we cannot agree with. And it's not that the book was not inspired. What it is, it's an inspired record of what this man went through. And he tells us the kinds of things he thought when he was backslidden. And what inspiration, the purpose inspiration serves in this case, is simply to confirm the veracity of the statements. That is to say, we know in the Bible that there are records not only of God's words, but there's also a record of things that evil men said. The words of Ahab, the words of Satan are recorded even. The Bible records words other than God's words. It records words of evil men and of the devil himself. And it is not so that we should just have a view of inspiration that we can turn to any place in the Bible at random and put it down and find something that is equally applicable to our lives as any other passage, because we need to understand the purpose of inspiration. Many of the a major part of the Bible is simply historical. And inspiration was not even needed for its writing, though we believe the writers were inspired to write down accurate history. Yet the inspiration of the deeds that are recorded there, there's certainly the record of evil acts done by many of the kings of Israel and Judah. It doesn't mean that because that's in the inspired word that those are recommended courses of action. Or just because it records counsel of wicked men, it doesn't mean that we should take that counsel because God inspired the writing of that history. So here also, not everything that Solomon said and believed when he was a backslider has any value. Some of it has no value at all. Some of it contains real common sense kind of wisdom. Because even as a backslider, he didn't become totally stupid, although there is some folly in backsliding. Just in backsliding, you show a man shows himself to be somewhat foolish. But he still had a bit of common sense in some respects, and so we find some of the things he talked about and mused on when he was backslidden still do have value. But many of them have no value, except to show us the emptiness of a man away from God, the emptiness of a backslider. G. Campbell Morgan is sometimes called the Prince of Bible Commentators. And he made this statement about the book of Ecclesiastes. He said, "Ecclesiastes is an inspired confession of failure and pessimism when God is excluded. When man lives under the sun and forgets the larger part which is always over the sun, the eternal and abiding things. If you want to know what a man of great privilege and of great learning and great wisdom can come to, read this record of a man who has put God out of count in his actual life." So we see that the book is inspired in that God inspired Solomon to write down this information of his empty search for happiness apart from God, so that we can read it today and not have to search in all those empty places he did. The idea is that it seems to be something that he wrote when he repented in old age, and perhaps he wrote the book more or less to atone for his mistakes by warning others not to go the same way. And so the general tenor of the book is very pessimistic. And because it records the musings of Solomon over a period of years, the things he thought while he was backslidden, we'll find statements that contradict each other in it. And some things that we just cannot away with at all. Some things that we cannot admit are true. Some of the statements that are found in here that are not true. For instance, chapter 1, verse 9. At the very end of the verse, it says, "There is no new thing under the sun." Well, we know that in Jesus, all things are become new. That there really is newness. God makes all things new, in the new heaven and the new earth, and also in our lives. We don't accept the fact that there's nothing new, that everything is old and has been before. In the same chapter, verse 15, he says, "That which is crooked cannot be made straight." Yet in Isaiah 40, in verse 4, it said the voice crying in the wilderness would say, "Make the crooked way straight. Prepare the way of the Lord." So that Solomon is very pessimistic in his backslidden state and says, if something's crooked, it can't be made straight. But we disagree, because we're not backslidden. We're not seeing things strictly from the perspective of one under the sun. We are seeing things from the perspective of those who have been seated with Christ in heavenly places, the perspective of one who is elevated above the natural level of this earth, and see things differently. But we can take instruction from this book. It is profitable for instruction in righteousness and for reproof and so forth, because we can see the mistakes another man made and avoid making them ourselves, hopefully. Someone said the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn anything from history. And it's true that people seem to make the same mistakes over and over again. And history doesn't seem to teach them anything. Their mistakes seem to be repeatable. An old saying says that a wise man learns from others' mistakes. A fool has to learn from his own mistakes. But we who want to be wise can learn from Solomon's mistakes. And it is, if Solomon had never written this book, we would have no record, first of all, of what he was thinking about and how empty his life was while he was backslidden. The book of 1 Kings that records his life does not dwell on the emptiness of his life and his unhappiness in his backslidden state. This book alone reveals it. And secondly, we would not know that he ever repented, because 1 Kings makes no reference to him ever repenting. But this book makes it clear that at the end of his life as an old man, he repented and sought to warn others not to go the wrong way. Some of the other things that he had felt while he was backslidden that were false. In chapter 2, verse 16, at the end he says, "And how dies the wise man, even as the fool?" He's basically saying that there's no difference in death for the wise or for the fool. It doesn't matter if you're good or bad, wise or foolish. Everyone's the same in death. Well, it's not exactly true. He didn't know about life after death when he was backslidden. In chapter 9, in verse 11, he says, "I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all." Essentially, it's saying that everything's governed by chance, and that it doesn't matter how hard you run, you're not going to win the race by running. No matter how how much you labor, it's not going to matter at all. It's all chance anyway. It's all predestined, and we don't believe that that's true. We believe it does matter whether we labor or whether we run the race well. Another thing he says that is definitely mistaken is chapter 7 and verse 16, where he says, "Be not righteous too much, neither make thyself overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself?" While he was backslidden, this thought crossed his mind. Why be too wise? Why be too righteous? You just kill yourself by trying to be too righteous. And of course, we don't agree with that. We don't believe it's possible to be too righteous. Now, even within his own book, he contradicts himself a number of times. The main purpose of the book is to demonstrate what the reasons are for cynicism. Why should I be cynical? Well, I'll tell you why I should be cynical. And in chapter 1, verses 4 through 10, he says one reason is that everything seems to go in a directionless, repetitious cycle. Nothing really changes. Everything just goes in big circles. And a man's life doesn't account for much of anything. He lives and dies, and everything goes on as it was going to go before. That's a cause for cynicism, he says. Another cause for cynicism is that the more knowledge you get, the more grief you get. He says that in chapter 1, verses 17 and 18. Another reason for cynicism is that mirth and indulgence are unsatisfying madness, he says. That's chapter 2, verses 3 through 11. We'll read these verses, but I just want to sort of scan through for these concepts. That even mirth, which we would is like partying and self-indulgence, they're unsatisfying madness. That's a cause for general cynicism about life. The fourth thing is that death is the common destiny of all. It doesn't matter if you're good or bad, wise or foolish, you all die. Again, that's cause for cynicism, for pessimism. The fifth thing, and all that, by the way, is found in chapter 2, verses 14 through 23, and in other places. There's three other spots where he mentions that. Then the fifth thing is that there is oppression and corruption in high places. That's cause for being cynical, for sure. In the high places of governments, there is oppression and there's corruption. And he talks about that in several places also. Chapter 3, verse 16. Chapter 4, verse 1. Chapter 8, verse 14. Then the sixth thing, it says another cause for cynicism is even wealth deprives its owner of peace of mind. We'll read about that in the fifth chapter, verses 10 through 17. Even wealth doesn't make you happy. It takes away peace of mind more than anything. The seventh thing that makes him cynical is that women can't be trusted. Now, he had a lot of women in his life, and he concluded at one point in chapter 7, verses 26 through 29, that women are untrustworthy, and that gives him cause for pessimism and cynicism. The eighth thing that he says is a cause for cynicism is that man's fate and his rewards come to him just by chance and not by any merit of his own. It doesn't matter if he's good or not. His fate seemed to fall just by chance and not by anything he's done. That's found in chapter 9, verse 11. We read that a minute ago. And the ninth thing that he gives as causes for cynicism is that men are more esteemed for social status than for wisdom or virtue. That is, if a person has position, he's more likely to be remembered and honored than if he has virtue or honor or wisdom. That is brought out in chapter 9, verses 13 through 16. So you can see he makes a solid case for cynicism. And therefore his statement in verse 2, vanity of vanities, emptiness of emptiness, everything is emptiness under the sun. And that's what he's saying here. 37 times he uses the word emptiness in this book. 37 times in 12 chapters he speaks of how empty things are. And he mentions under the sun 28 times, which means that he's talking strictly of seeing things from the earthly perspective, not the way that God sees it. Now, as we read through, we'll try to trace his thought. He starts out by telling us that he was the king in Jerusalem and that he was the son of David. That identifies him with Solomon. And then he talks about an experiment he made, basically to find out what the chief good of man was, but seeking that information after he'd departed from God. He departed from God and he found that his life was not satisfying. Therefore, he decided an experiment to try everything he could to see what would bring satisfaction. Now, he was able to try things that many modern people just dream that they would be able to do. People who think that sex is going to make them happy will never get as many women as Solomon had. He had 1,000, 700 wives and 300 concubines. He had opportunity to test the potential of sexual intercourse bringing happiness or not. His conclusions should be authoritative on that matter. As far as people who think that money is going to make them happy, no one had more money than Solomon. And he ought to know whether money can make people happy or not. There are many people who wish that they could obtain certain things which they hope will make them happy apart from God. But Solomon had the chance to try all those things. Some people think education is going to do it. He tried that too. He said it's all emptiness. The more you learn, the more grief you get. The more aware of the conditions in the world that you are, the more you're going to be upset about it. And so he could try everything that people put their confidence in and the things that they hope will make them happy. But in hoping in those things, people are only rejecting God as the sole source of human happiness. This is the search for the highest good and for personal fulfillment under the sun. And that's what we read about. Now, from time to time, he's going to make a comment that we can agree with. And you say, well, if some of the statements can be trusted and some can't, then how can we divide between them? Well, it's quite easy. The Bible in other places where there are direct statements from God can be consulted to see whether or not the statement we're looking at is in conflict or in agreement with what God says elsewhere. But note that it is possible for an inspired document, inspired book from God, written by Solomon, to contain statements that cannot be trusted because he does not intend for us to trust them. He's basically telling us what he was thinking when he was deceived. But now that he's not deceived, he brings us to his final conclusion in chapter 12. Serve God, fear God, keep his commandments. That's his message of this book. That's what this sermon is. It's a sermon about the emptiness of life when you're not serving God. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is emptiness, vanity. What profit hath the man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passes away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to its circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, to there they return again, though he no doubt didn't quite know how they return there again. We know because of evaporation and precipitation that the water does return ultimately back to the hills and drains off into the lakes and feeds the rivers and all, but he didn't quite know how that happened because they didn't have that knowledge yet. But he did know that the rivers seem to, the water that goes down goes into the sea, but it doesn't fill up the sea. Somehow it goes back up to where the river started and keeps it flowing. And what he's saying about this is that everything's in a monotonous cycle. Nothing is really going to change. You can put in your best efforts at life, but you're not really going to change anything. It's all going to happen. One generation passes away, another one comes up, but the earth's still there. It doesn't change. The wind blows around in circles. The sun comes up on one end of the horizon, goes down the other end, but goes back to where it started and comes back up again. The waters, there's nothing that really can be pointed to that is a continual progress in history, he's saying. History is making no progress. It's just going in big circles. And that's why he said in verses 8 and 9, he says, all things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. The thing that has been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. That's one of his causes for being cynical. When he was not following the Lord, his life lost that newness that we have walking with Jesus. It says in 2 Corinthians 5, in verse 17, that if any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. All things are passed away, and behold, all things are become new. That's the excitement of being a Christian, that you are a new creation every day. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul says, though the outward man perish, the inner man is renewed day by day. There's a newness about every day. There's no time to become bored if we're walking with Jesus, because he has new grounds for us to conquer in our lives. He has new victories to be won. He has new blessings to bestow. Morning by morning, new mercies, we see. So there are new things under the sun for those who are in the Son Jesus, that is. And so this is the pessimism that only a person without God could have. And he was without God when he began saying these things, as we will see. He said, is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come after those that shall come after, or that are to come with those that shall come after. Now what he's saying here is, can you point to anything new? Anything you think is new has been around before. Now, in a certain worldly sense, that's to be seen to be true, that there's hardly anything that's happening now in the society. Modern as our society may seem, hardly anything that happens has not been done before, except for things that technology has made possible, like walking on the moon and things. Those things weren't done before. But as far as life patterns, as far as sins, for example, there's no new sins. All the new sins, or those which seem to be modern and new sins, are just repeats of old sins that have been done from the very beginning. The conditions in society, corruption, all those things, that's nothing new. It's all been done before. Things aren't really changing in the world of the unjust. In the kingdom of God, things are always changing. But outside the kingdom of God, things are just going on. It says in 2 Peter that God's just reserving this present order until judgment. He's just keeping it from disappearing. He's not taking it anywhere except for those who are being brought into him. Worldly society is not going to make any progress, in other words, in goodness. Evolution is not taking place. Man is not evolving in something higher. Society is not being transformed into something better than it used to be. That's something that Solomon recognized, as we can recognize also. However, his pessimism would not have been warranted if he knew the Lord, because things would be new in his life all the time. Verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is emptiness and vexation of spirit. This expression, vexation of spirit, actually in the Hebrew means striving after the wind. The word spirit and wind are the same word in Hebrew. So it's actually vexation of wind or of spirit, but almost certainly what he's saying is that it's like chasing the wind, like Donovan said, try and catch the wind. It'd be a rather frustrating enterprise since you can't lay your hand on it. And it's saying it's like vexing your spirit or like chasing after the wind. It's just a futile effort that'll only bring frustration. Now, everything he's found in wisdom. Now, people seek to find fulfillment in wisdom and in education today. They're hoping that the more they learn, the more they'll be happy. But he says that's not the way it is. He tried that. He was educated more than any man of his time. He says there's nothing that goes on the planet Earth that I haven't studied. And he said in verse 15, that which is crooked cannot be made straight. That which is wanting cannot be numbered. I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly too. He wanted to be able to perceive the difference between wisdom and folly. I perceived that this also is striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Boy, that is true in a sense. The more knowledge you give what's going on in the world, the more sorrowful you can become if you're only getting one side of the picture. We see the world does seem to be going down the tubes, and there's much injustice, there's much pain, there's much starvation, there's much death. That's depressing. And the more we know about it, the more depressed we can get. However, we are not looking at the things that are seen, but on the things that are not seen, 2 Corinthians chapter 4 tells us. Because we're not looking at the things that are temporal, the visible world. We're looking at the invisible world. What is God doing? The more I know about what's going on in the world, the more I'm likely to get depressed if I'm looking at the things that are visible and seen. But if I'm looking at that which is not seen, I can say, what is God doing? And with increased knowledge of what God is doing comes not much grief, but much hope, great anticipation. When I hear that there are thousands of new churches every month being planted somewhere in the world, and that the number of people attending the Protestant churches in Latin America is increasing three times as fast as the population growth of that fast-growing region, that's encouraging. Now, that kind of thing wouldn't excite someone who's just living under the sun, who doesn't love the Lord, but when I see that God is moving secretly, all without a great deal of fanfare, but we're looking not at the things that are seen, the more we know of God and of His dealings, the more happy we will become. But it is true, if we can't see God, then the more we know, the more we're going to be grieved and pessimistic, as Solomon was at one point in his life. Chapter 2, he's finished talking about how wisdom failed to satisfy that inner craving for meaning. He decided to check out pleasure, and he had opportunity to do that more than most of us will ever have opportunity to do. He says, I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth, or partying. Therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also, he says, is vanity. After he tried it, he said, it's emptiness too. Don't get deceived by it. Now he tells us what he had said about it. He says, I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly. Now what he's saying is, I was experimenting to see how much I could drink without losing my wits, without losing my discernment between wisdom and folly. I wanted to be able to still maintain my wisdom, still acquainting my heart with wisdom, and still being able to lay hold on folly in the sense of being able to get a handle on what folly is and what wisdom is. But of course we know that drinking takes away that judgment of those things. But he was experimenting. He says, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. I made me great works. Some people feel like being a workaholic is going to take away the emptiness. Working, always on some project, never taking time to sit down and recollect their thoughts, never taking time to take stock of their conscience or of their inner man. This is the only way they know to relieve the emptiness of their life. Just fill it up with activity and with work. He did that. He says, I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards. I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruit. He got into gardening, which some people find therapeutic. He didn't find it very therapeutic at all. He was searching for meaning and he didn't find it in that. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens and had servants born in my house. I also had great possessions. So riches he had also. Some people think that's going to do it. Great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers. So he got some concerts going in the palace there. Brought in the rock bands and stuff, thinking maybe rock and roll music will drown my sorrows. He got in his singers and his musicians, men and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, his musical instruments, and that of all sorts, but music didn't do it either. So I was great and increased more than all they that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. That is, he kept his wits enough to realize that this wasn't really cutting it. Some people get so enamored in these things that they think they've found the meaning of life. I met someone who was into the Grateful Dead so much they thought that being into the dead was really the meaning of life. As if that were not a contradiction in terms, even in itself. But some people think by rock and roll music or partying or something or surfing or some other activity that brings them temporal joy, this will be the thing that gives them... And basically it does numb them for a while. Solomon, for a while, must have been numbed by these things in order to keep pursuing them. When you get drunk, you probably think you're having a good time. When you wake up the next day, you know you aren't. And Solomon tried all these things and no doubt found them to be numbing his sensibilities to some degree, but he kept his wisdom enough to come to his senses later and say, wait a minute, that didn't do it. I'm no happier now than I was before. I'm just an addict now. So he says, my wisdom remained with me, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. So he didn't have to deny himself of all those fancy cars and things like that, that we think if we just had one of those, that would make me a lot happier. Then, you know, I wouldn't want anything more than that. But whatever his eyes desired, he gave them. He could do it in his position, being the king and being rich. He said, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, or striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king? Even that which hath already been done. In other words, anyone who comes after him who thinks that they can find happiness under the sun, there's nothing they can do that he hasn't done. He's the king. He says, what can a man do who comes after me? What can my descendants do more than what I did? They can't do anything, but I've already tried it. And they won't find happiness, I can predict, in those things. So he says in verse 13, then I saw that wisdom excels folly as far as light excels darkness. Now, he came back around to wisdom again because he decided that pleasure wasn't doing it. So he thought, well, maybe wisdom, maybe somewhere in there. The wisdom, after all, is better than folly. Just indulging in all your pleasures is folly. He tried that after he tried all the wisdom. And then he came back to wisdom and said, well, wisdom makes more sense than stupidity does. And then just profligacy does. So he said, wisdom excels folly, like light excels the darkness. A wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. And I myself perceived also that the one event happened to them all, that is, namely, death. No matter whether you're wise or foolish, the same thing happens ultimately. Then I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, so it happens even to me. And why was I then more wise? What was the point of even getting all that wisdom if I'm going to die anyway? Then I said in my heart that this also is emptiness, for there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever, seeing that which now is in the days to come shall be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? As the fool. Therefore I hated life And that's the grief and the emptiness he came to. He hated his life. Again, 1 Kings doesn't bring out this inner turmoil and emptiness and hatred for life that he went through. Only his own testimony can bring that out with authenticity. I hated life because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me. For all is emptiness and striving after the wind. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it to the man that should be after me. And who knows whether he shall be wise or a fool. Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This also is emptiness. Now it's, boy, that makes me not want to do anything. Makes me not want to accomplish anything, because I know I'm going to die, and then my son's going to come take it over, and who knows if he's going to do something wisely. Maybe I'll spend my whole life behaving wisely and building up my empire, but then at the end I have to leave it to my son and he'll just destroy it by his foolishness. It makes me not want to work. It makes me hate life. It makes me hate labor. It makes my labor grievous to me, not knowing whether it will endure after I'm gone and whether it shall produce any lasting results. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity. Yet to a man that hath not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is emptiness and a great evil. So he's saying, Here I am, a man who labors to become wise, but I have to leave everything I have to a man who hasn't gone to that same labor to be wise. And I can't make him wise. He has to seek the wisdom with the same effort I did. I can't leave my wisdom to him exactly. I can only hope that he will seek wisdom like I do, and as far as that goes, not many do, therefore it's a pretty vain hope. He says it's all vanity and a great evil. For what hath a man of all his labor, and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows, and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This is also vanity. There is nothing better. Now here in verse 24, he decides what the best thing in life is. This is not his final conclusion. His final conclusion at the end of the book is that we're to fear God and keep his commandments. But during his backslidden stage, he tentatively arose at some conclusions about what the best thing a man can do is. It's stated here, and it's stated several other places, in about four different times this essential conclusion was drawn during his backslidden condition. Here he says, there is nothing better before for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This I also saw, that it was from the hand of God. Now what he's saying is, the best you can hope for is to enjoy life now. You're going to die. No sense in being frugal. No sense in being wise. You're going to leave it to someone else. He might waste it all. You might as well enjoy it now. The things you labor for, use them. Enjoy yourself. Enjoy life. Eat, drink, and be merry is essentially what he's saying. There's nothing better than a man should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good, the good of his labor, meaning the good produce of his work. So enjoy your money. That's the best you can do. Try to get all the gusto you can. You only go around once in life. It's essentially what this book is saying. Now that's what he was saying when he was in the world. It's interesting how many people in the world today say the exact same thing. They could learn from his lesson if they'd only read his testimony. But he says, this I also saw, that it was from the hand of God, meaning the fruit of the labor. That's from God, isn't it? Then it must be a good thing to just enjoy it. Well, true enough, there's nothing wrong with enjoying the blessings of God. But if you're just here to get blessed and just to enjoy and just have a good time with the things that God has blessed you with, you're missing the whole point of life. Then he says in verse 25, for who can eat, or who else can hasten hereunto more than I? For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge.